Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at a bill that just passed the U.S. House that lawmakers say will save the U.S. Postal Service $50 billion in the next 10 years. First, more than 100,000 Americans died from drug overdoses over a one-year period starting in May of 2020. That's up 30% over the previous year. The recent rise of fentanyl is a big part of the story. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid that's mixed into other drugs, making them more potent and deadly. Yesterday, the Bipartisan Federal Commission on Combating Synthetic Opioid Trafficking put out a report with dozens of recommendations on how to deal with the problem. On the list of suggestions, more coordination of law enforcement and diplomatic efforts to curb the flow of fentanyl between countries. The commission also said reducing demand for drugs in the U.S. was a part of the answer and called for more investment and research into addiction treatment. We're talking now with a journalist who's been following this issue for years about the new challenges created by synthetic drugs, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Has drug use or drug overdose affected you or your loved ones? Do you worry about the danger posed by drugs containing fentanyl? What do you think can be done about it? If you work in addiction treatment or in law enforcement, have you seen things change in recent years? Call in with your questions, your stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sam Quiñones is a journalist and author who's covered the drug trade for years. His books include Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, and his latest, The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. Sam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here with you, Rob. Thanks very much.
We hear a lot about the dangers of fentanyl. Can you remind us what fentanyl is and why it is so hazardous?
Well, actually, fentanyl is a magnificent drug when used medically. Mm-hmm. It has revolutionized surgery. It has made surgery possible, but before it was not, or much more difficult, would have been much more difficult. It's a synthetic opioid invented in 1960. And one of the reasons, there's a couple of reasons why it became such a good anesthetic and did so much, had so much benefit in the surgical context. One of them is it's extraordinarily potent. But it's short lasting. It comes in and out very, very quickly. And so I've had fentanyl myself when I had a cardiac surgery after a heart attack. I'm very happy that I did, because you come out very quickly and you're not doped up for, you know, hours and hours after its use. You can be actually almost coherent. I was when they were putting a stent in me. And so the problem is that when this drug, which is an extraordinarily potent opioid, is then in the hands of people who don't have a clue how to use it or only are interested in the profit, because it's also an opioid. So it has the same addictive potential, actually even more enhanced addictive potential as heroin. It hits the same parts of our brain, the reward system in our brain as heroin does, and it creates massive withdrawals just the way heroin does. And so it's a drug that's been widely used in medicine, and in the last few years become widely used primarily because of its down in Mexico, they have learned how to make it, and they have access to the world chemical markets through several ports, and that allows them to make fentanyl in quantities that are simply staggering and have really covered the country with it.
And you've looked at the changing supply chain. We use this phrase supply chain for legal products. It has changed a lot for the production of fentanyl, from being produced entirely in China to, as you say, precursor chemicals. Can you talk about the changing flow of these products?
Sure. At first, the place where it was really coming from was China, in fact. The chemical companies, thousands of chemical companies over there, they began selling it on the dark web or also sometimes on the open internet. Some of the clients for that fentanyl were the traffickers in Mexico. In my book, The Least of Us, I tell the story of how the Mexican trafficking world discovered fentanyl through an underground chemist who later was then arrested, and they didn't really have access to him. So several years passed, but they never forgot that there was this synthetic heroin that could be produced in a lab instead of growing poppies. The Chinese began to produce it, but then in a few years ago, the Chinese government put a regulation on the number of companies that could actually produce fentanyl, and that meant that they did not control the ingredients that go into how you make fentanyl. And those companies that were selling fentanyl are now making the ingredients, selling that. And now what's happened in Mexico is the trafficking world down there has really learned how to make fentanyl and probably a few other chemical cousins, analogs of fentanyl as well. And they're getting those ingredients now from the Chinese chemical companies that many of which I believe once made fentanyl itself.
Talking to Sam Quiñones, author of books including The Least of Us, True Tales of America, and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth, looking at the hazards of the drug fentanyl when used and produced illegally. You can join in with your thoughts, your stories at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Chandra is with us in Ironwood, Michigan. Chandra, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
You know, I'm a recovering addict. I was prescribed OxyContin at a real young age, precursors to addiction, became addicted for about 16 years plus, really struggled with finding resources for addiction and also struggling with chronic pain. I have chronic pain from a birth defect in the spine. And so once that was taken away from me, I needed alternative solutions, but I also needed solutions for recovery so that I didn't fall back into synthetic opioids or prescription medication abuse. One of the things that I found that has been profound for me has been kratom. It's a plant from Southeast Asia. It's an evergreen. The leaves itself are ground up into a powder, and it interacts with opioid receptors in a much safer manner and also has an activity ceiling. So, therefore, you don't get suppressed breathing or heart rate to the point where overdose is imminent. So my two cents is, you know, looking into these botanical drugs, regulating them more appropriately, and creating safe access points where people have alternatives to, opioid treatment that may not necessarily be synthetic opioids.
Chandra, thanks a lot for the call. I know kratom is controversial to say the least, Sam, but on the treatment side of things, that's part of this report we're talking about. Do you have thoughts on kratom, first of all, and then on wider issues of helping people like Chandra, and glad you're in recovery, Chandra, stay in recovery?
Yes, I mean, I think we do need to think of a variety of things that were kind of sidelined when we had this very laser focus on using opioid painkillers as the solution to pain. I think in the pain management world, the idea had been and now is returning to credence that we need to have a variety of treatment options for chronic pain. The problem was really we tried to do cure all pain with one kind of pill for all kinds of human beings, and that just didn't work really. And the idea being that now I think that, as I said, was very popular during the 70s and 80s and just got aced out by the opioid issue, is that we now need a wide variety of reimbursable treatment solutions that doctors can then meet and act as kind of a teammate with the patient on and adjust according to that individual's need. And that is what we've really been lacking, I think, when we're getting off the topic of synthetic drugs, I think, but that's really what's been lacking, I think, generally speaking, across the country when it comes to just managing chronic pain, is the idea that all human beings are different and they need a wide variety of options to deal with each individual case of pain.
Chandra, thanks again for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. That's a little bit about the treatment and the demand side, Sam. Let's get into recommendations from this report on enforcement to try to stop the flow of these synthetic drugs into the U.S., diplomatic efforts. It seems like there's a lot of whack-a-mole. Once you fix things in one spot, the supply chain changes, the route changes.
Well, yes, but I mean, The big issue we're dealing with is the problem of Mexico. Mexico has a criminal justice system that on a good day is mediocre. I would say I lived down there for 10 years. I wrote two books about Mexico. And you get this feeling that really nothing's being done. Actually, I would say that there's more likelihood of a significant impact now, because unlike the days when they were making mostly plant-based drugs, marijuana, poppies, which you can grow all over Mexico. Mexico's a vast country with very mountainous areas. The crux here is that these traffickers now need chemicals coming from the entire world chemical market through a few ports. Those ports are their bottlenecks. If we actually put significant resources combined as binational effort into controlling, examining, understanding the flow of those chemicals and blocking the chemicals that did not have a real good reason for being there, and controlling those chemicals into the port, you would immediately see a significant drop off. Would that production go somewhere else to another country? Maybe. But the reason we have so much methamphetamine and fentanyl, both synthetic drugs, all over the country, covering the country at prices that are historically low, is because in Mexico, they have this amazing capacity to get the chemicals, make the drugs, and then smuggle it across the 2,000-mile border with which we with the United States, where there's also a free trade agreement. So it might push it elsewhere, but I think that the quantities that we're seeing today, which are just staggering coast to coast, would significantly be impacted if we paid attention to those ports and in a binational way really address the enormous flow of chemicals that are coming through there, because that's really the Achilles heel of the trafficking world today.
We're talking to Sam Quinones right now, journalist and author of several books on the opioid epidemic and the drug trade, his latest, The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. We're looking at drugs like fentanyl, how they're raising the risks after a federal commission's report yesterday on how to try to curb the trafficking of these synthetic opioid drugs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has drug use or maybe a drug overdose impacted your life or that of a loved one? What do you want to see done to try to prevent addictions and deaths stemming from these more potent drugs containing fentanyl? What questions do you have for our guest? And if you work in the field, in addiction treatment, say, or law enforcement, what are you seeing where you are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with journalist and author Sam Quinones, whose books include The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. We're looking at the problems that synthetic drugs create and what can be done about it. You could join in with your questions, maybe your stories, at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Rick is with us in Neenah. Rick, hi.
Hello. About 20 years ago, I lost my sister. She was a heroin addict. And died from that. And I've looked at all of the things that have happened to her and have happened since, and it occurs to me that our best bet is to not try to stop it, is just to legalize it and then put into place controls, right? And the controls in the United States would also translate the controls elsewhere, which would have a gigantic impact on the crime, not only here in the United States, but worldwide. It would allow us to have funding to go ahead and treat opiate addiction as a public health crisis rather than as a criminal activity.
Rick, thanks for the call. Sorry for the loss of your sister. Sam, what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, we don't seem to be doing a very good job with marijuana. I go back and forth on this topic almost every day, maybe every hour, frankly. You know, we are dealing, though, with fentanyl here. The idea that people would make fentanyl legal for use, I just can't see how that would work. Honestly, it is too deadly. Now, heroin's another issue. On the other hand, I think I would like to see marijuana done well, and I don't think we're doing that well at all. You know, there's no attempt to put in strict controls on potency. There's no attempt to really inspect if it's a consumable, inspect it as a food or a consumable liquid would be inspected. If it's a medicine, inspect it the way a drug would be inspected. I mean, there's that's the kind of stuff that we need. And until we do something right with a drug like marijuana, I just don't I doubt our capacity to do that on a level with something like heroin. I also think that I just doubt our ability as Americans to do it. Other countries might be able to do it in a better way, but it seems to me that we just have this laissez-faire idea that when it comes to drugs is really going to be dangerous. We have this natural tendency, it seems to me, in this country to get out of the way of large concentrations of power and money and influence. And we see this in big pharma, big oil, you name it, big this, big that. And I think we need to put in place controls that would prevent big pot, let alone big fentanyl someday, you know.
Rick, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Sam, something you cover in your book, The Least of Us, we have actually a frequent public health guest here on the show, Dr. Patrick Remington, who writes about diseases of despair, which includes suicides, alcohol-related deaths, and drug overdose and drug-related deaths. You are looking at not just, you know, this individual demand, but kind of as a social problem, creating despair and a demand for these drugs. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think one of the things that struck me without me actually looking for it, but just couldn't avoid it early on in my first book, Dreamland, on this topic, was the idea that at root here was what we as a culture, as a country, have kind of inflicted on ourselves, which is this kind of generalized shredding of what brings us together, generalized shredding of community in many, many ways. You know, could be jobs going overseas and the community that's left behind is left to fend for itself. But it also could be, you know, municipal planning and a suburban development and all these different ways in which we have decided that the urge for community doesn't, we don't need to follow it, or that doesn't, old rules don't apply to us. When in fact, the idea behind community is one of the most powerful things, probably the most powerful idea that we evolved to prize, because it kept us alive. It allowed us to survive. It's this idea that we don't survive without others. And that's what allowed us as a species to survive. It's very clear to me. It's just that in the last 40 years in the United States, we seem to have decided that we don't need that kind of stuff. We don't want to pay taxes for it. We don't want to support it. If the jobs leave one community, well, that community is kind of on its own and deal with it, you know. And it just seems you could go on and on and on about the ways in which we have stripped and shredded the pillars and the bulwarks that keep us together as a community. And it was very difficult for me to avoid that conclusion as I was writing about first the opioid epidemic and now this synthetic drug era, which is the subject of the second book, The Least of Us. But the reason I called it the book The Least of Us, it's a book about synthetic drugs, but it's the heart and soul of the book is about people who understand the importance of community and in small ways are working in the smallest, least sexy ways are working to repair community, knowing that they are not saving the world in some noble, virtuous sense, knowing they're not necessarily going to be applauded or anything. It's just daily showing up to work at repairing and making their areas, their towns, their streets, whatever it happens to be, a better place. So my book is really about synthetic drugs, but the core of it, the heart and soul of it, is the idea that we possess within us as human beings, having evolved for the last millions of years, this essential nature, that's the most potent force more potent than drugs, it seems to me, except that in the United States, at least, we've decided that it's not that important that we could do without it.
I want to hear more about the hope side of your book, The Least of Us, Sam. Can you share an example of the kind of work you see people doing that is hopefully going to help rebuild that fabric and then help deal with problems like opioids?
Well, there are many stories, and it's not just dealing with opioids and addiction. I wanted to focus on. I was really focused on something broader. And so I'll tell you the story of Bird, a guy named Bird in the south, a neighborhood in South Muncie, Indiana. It used to be a town that was devoted to producing transmissions, transmission capital of America, two enormous plants right in that neighborhood where he lived. And And those plants began to wither away, and the jobs left, and finally they closed. The city decides, you know what, we have to do something. We don't have any budget to keep us going. So they decide we're going to close the community centers in each of the neighborhoods where we have them. One of them is right across from the street from Bird's house where he's grown up. He's worked there at that community center. And so the city leaders close the community center, they think, except that Bird keeps the key. Right. And so what ends up happening as the jobs are finally gone and as the opioid epidemic begins to really take a toll, Bird becomes a community center unto himself. He daily opens it for the kids to play basketball and for the older folks to play cards. And when there's a wedding or when there's a birthday, he is the community center, keeping it alive when the city leaders really thought it was closed. They didn't really know that he was opening it. All the time. They certainly put no budget into it. He's the one fixing the toilets, the one mowing the lawns. And for several years that way, he keeps that neighborhood, gives that neighborhood a center through which it can weather some of the most stressful economic and drug-induced problems that they've ever had. It's that kind of story that I wanted to tell. Nobody has ever told Bird's story. I just kind of stumbled on it myself, and it was an exhilarating moment when I did. But the idea was not so much to deal with addiction per se, but to deal with the idea of how do we do things to keep ourselves in community and connected to one another, even when there doesn't seem to be any way to do it. I mean, the easiest thing for him to do would throw up his hands and say, oh, well, what are we going to do? Instead, he says, you know what? Folks need this. This is a way that we can weather some very tough times. Don't know how long it'll last. And he just goes ahead and every day opens that center for the kids and for the folks who need to use it.
And Sam, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure.
That's Sam Quiñones, journalist, author of books about the opioid epidemic, including Dreamland and his latest, The Least of Us. He joined us to talk about the rise of fentanyl in the drug market and a variety of solutions on the table. Find a link to a new report on the issue at WPR.org/Central Time. If you or someone you know is dealing with substance use or addiction, the Department of Health and Human Service National Helpline is 800-662-HELP. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Kohl's has survived a hostile takeover attempt for now, but others may still be interested in buying the retail company. We'll talk to a business reporter about what it all means for the Menominee Falls retailer and its Wisconsin employees and customers. Now, the U.S. House passed yesterday a bill that supporters say will save the U.S. Postal Service $50 billion in the coming decade. The Postal Service Reform Act includes cost-cutting measures for the USPS, which, unlike other government agencies, doesn't receive taxpayer funding. The bill now goes to the Senate, where Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has promised to take it up before the end of next week. We're talking about this bill that will overhaul funding for the Postal Service, which has been struggling to stay afloat financially for years. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been hoping for some kind of changes in the Postal Service? Do you think the USPS should be funded directly by taxpayers or continue with its current funding model based on money from stamps and package deliveries? Does declining snail mail mean the USPS, you think, has outlived its worth? Or is there always going to be a need for the Postal Service? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. James O'Rourke is a teaching professor of management and organization at the University of Notre Dame's Mendoza College of Business. He's studied the U.S. Postal Service for over a decade. James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been hearing these issues in the news for a long time now, James, concerns about the future of the Postal Service funding. Why are we seeing action in Congress now?
We have driven up to the edge of the cliff, and the Congress of the United States finally said, oh, this doesn't look good. They knew about this for the last 10 years, but elected to do nothing. And in so many ways, like a continuing resolution or stopgap measures, they chose not to fix the real problem and just boot that down the road. They're out of those options now. There's no more booting If they don't fix it, the Postal Service could go bankrupt, and the rescue would be far more painful and expensive than an actual fix. So congratulations to the House of Representatives. They voted yesterday 342 to 92 on this new measure, and it looks as though the Senate version has at least a dozen Republicans on board. So that's enough to move this measure to President Biden's desk.
Before we dig into some of the solutions, can you define the problem for us? Why do we keep hearing year after year that the Postal Service is facing a financial crunch?
Well, their expenses exceed their revenues. I mean, even freshman business school students understand that's the problem. The Postal Service, in an ordinary quarter, three-month period, would report about $18.5 billion in revenues, but they will lose generally between $2 and $3 billion in the same period. So you have one of two choices. You can cut your costs or you can increase your revenues. They have $200 billion in long-term debt they cannot pay for. And ultimately, when they run out of operating revenue, it no longer looks like an interesting footnote in the balance sheet. It means they can't pay for motor gas, they can't pay salaries, they cannot order supplies, they can't heat the building, so they've got to padlock the front door. This measure, I think, is a really important first step to closing down that gap.
One problem people have pointed toward was the USPS having to pre-fund retiree health care in advance. That's one of the things this measure tackles. Could you talk about the problem and how Congress is trying to solve it?
Well, that's right. I mean, this is part of a bill that was passed in 2016, and in what is widely regarded as an absurd approach to retiree health care, the Postal Service was required to fund in advance the full amount for anyone currently working for the Postal Service, and then it was extended further out in time to cover people they haven't even hired. Last year, the USPS did not make $63 billion in required payments to fund postal retiree health and pension benefits through the fiscal year. So those two funds are going to run out of money, and retired postal workers will receive no pension, and they will have no health care. It's silly because the rest of us have joined Medicare. I'm a retired United States Air Force officer, and when I turned 65, the Department of Defense sent me a note and said, "Congratulations, Colonel, you're now on Medicare." And I got to tell you, I've had no problem with it. I like it. It's seamless, and it works exceptionally well. They take the cost of the Medicare, the monthly payments, out of my Social Security check, and it really works quite well. Big companies, for-profit companies in this country, no longer offer defined benefit retirement. I mean, General Motors in the 1950s was known as Generous Motors. No longer. They went to the United Auto Workers and said, "Here's a very large bag of cash. The retirement program belongs to you." So UAW workers' retirements are managed by the United Auto Workers Union. Medicare handles the health care benefits. So the Postal Service workers continued on with their own health care service, their own private retirement system, and they went further and further in debt. And eventually that's unsustainable. And eventually, by the way, is about 6 to 8 months from now.
Talking to James O'Rourke at the University of Notre Dame, looking at a bill just passed the House. It appears likely to pass the Senate to shake up the way the U.S. Postal Service is funded and avoid some of the problems James is talking about in the short run. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Appleton. Mark, hi.
Hi. I think that it's important that we continue to have a U.S. Postal Service. There's been talk about privatizing that kind of service, but I am very much against it. But it's also important to recognize that if we looked at other agencies of the U.S. government, I can't say that they all run at a profit. And I'll just look at, you know, the military is a service. We call it the United States service. Where's the profit in that? We all give a little bit of money to maintain that for the benefit of everybody. And I think the Postal Service should fit into that.
Mark, thanks for the call. A couple points there, James. First of all, that second point that the U.S. Postal Service is supposed to be, in effect, self-funding. Why this one unit of government? I think Amtrak might be in the same boat. Why that way instead of, as Mark said, fund it like the military?
Well, exactly. In the Ronald Reagan years, Mrs. Thatcher in the UK, President Reagan in the US, there was a huge move to put everybody on their own balance sheet, each tub on its own bottom, and Amtrak fit into the same category. The Canadians and the British call those crown corporations. But I would tell you that no democracy can run without a postal service. And a while back, I said to a friend in the hallway, you know, our post office is starting to look like a third world country. And he said, oh, no, Jim. Third world countries have really good postal services. So the point really is, who should pay for that? I think the thing we all agree on is that the Postal Service doesn't have to make money, but it ought to break even. One of the things this new bill doesn't yet mention is around $200 billion in long-term debt owed to the United States Treasury. Now, if I were looking at the balance sheet of a publicly traded company and I saw that no payments had been made in a number of years and that this company could never possibly earn its way out of that hole, I would say, you know, the Securities and Exchange Commission rules require that you write this off as a bad debt. I would say to the Treasury, do the same thing. Forget about that $200 billion. The Congress can give them the money as a loan, or you can write it off. It's a net zero either way. But if that's true, if they'll do that, that obviates about $16 to $18 billion in payments every year. So let's begin there. The other two issues are requiring postal employees to open a 401k or 405b and hiring a service like Fidelity or TIA, Craft, somebody else, to do the record keeping and help postal workers manage that. But they're going to have to make those contributions on their own, perhaps with a small match from the Postal Service. And, of course, the other thing that this bill does is say you're now required to join Medicare. I did not see a provision in there that would allow the Congress to forgive the late enrollment penalty. If you don't enroll in Medicare Part A, Part B, when you're eligible, the penalty for not doing so gets steeper and steeper each year. The Congress has got to simply say, you know, we'll forgive that, get these people on the rolls as soon as we can. You know, I would say we really need a postal service. You posed a question earlier about whether the post office has outlived its usefulness. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, if you ask your friends, oh, I take my packages to FedEx or I take them to UPS or DHL or wherever because they're more reliable. And I would say, well, yes, but that $2.85 envelope you give to the Postal Service is going to be $23 at FedEx. And I think the people who are hurt the most are people without a lot of money, the poor, and I would say not just the lower decile, the lower 20% of this nation. depend heavily on the post office. And frankly, we can do better. You know, my sense is the Congress is doing the right thing, and we can talk about Mr. DeJoy and his plan if you like, but I'm happy to hear from your listeners.
We continue our talk with James O'Rourke. He's a teaching professor of management and organization at the University of Notre Dame, talking about a Postal Service funding overhaul bill that just passed the U.S. House on its way to the Senate, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your hopes for the post office, your questions for our guest. 800-642-1234. Do you rely on the post office where you live, especially maybe in a rural area? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll pick up the conversation, hear from some more of you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with James O'Rourke, teaching professor of management and organization at the University of Notre Dame, looking at a bill in Congress that'll overhaul the U.S. Postal Service finances. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Go back to your calls now. Brad is with us in Appleton. Hi, Brad.
Hey, how you doing? I just got a question. I was wondering, how will this impact current retirees?
Are you one, or do you know one, Brad?
My dad. He just retired from the post office last year.
All right. Well, congratulations on retirement to your dad, Brad. James, would this affect, this bill in Congress affect people already retired from the Postal Service?
That's not clear, but I think as the Senate and House version get worked out in conference committee, that I'll go with a yes on that. And I think here's how it'll work. I think the money that's currently in the retiree trust fund that's being held to make payments for pensions and for Medicare, or for medical care, would be used to buy those retirees into the Medicare system and to fund, at least jumpstart, the 401ks. There may be some pushback here and there, particularly in the pension side, but I think they'll work that out, and I do think current retirees will be included. Obviously, everybody who is not yet retired but employed by the Postal Service will be affected. The issue, I think, based on Mark's call and his question a little earlier, is should every government agency be required to make money? He's right. The United States Department of Defense does not make money. They have no revenue sources. So the National Defense Authorization Act is paid for by the American people, all of it. But there are services that do make money. The National Weather Service, the Park Service, there are some others. And there has been talk going around for years about privatizing those operations. Again, I would agree with Mark. I think that's a terrible idea. I don't want to see Georgia Pacific own or buy out the National Forest Service. I don't want to see an entertainment and amusement park firm buy out the National Park Service. What the post office needs is to continue charging reasonable fees for their services. They need to improve their services, but they also need new revenue streams. And Senator Kirsten Gillibrand agrees with me that one place to start is community banking. About one-third of Americans, it's a huge number, it's something approaching 100 million people, have either no banking services or are underbanked. The post office is in a perfect position to provide low-dollar bank accounts. And these are accounts, by the way, the major banks don't want. They're just not profitable enough. But they're all over America. They're on various street corners. You can walk in and buy savings bonds. They have staff who are trained to take money and keep good records. Community banking would be a really good idea. And from my personal point of view, it would keep those people away from payday lenders and loan sharks, the predatory folks in that end of the unbanked community. The other thing they could do is rent some of their properties. They have a lot of non-revenue producing properties they could lease or sell. Further, they could get into to licenses, selling hunting and fishing licenses and other such things. There are plenty of revenue streams they could take on. And I would say about Postmaster DeJoy, I'm told he's a nice guy. He won't take my calls, but I'm told he's a nice fellow. But he came to the Postal Service from the logistics business, and his training in that enterprise really is around cost cutting. You move into that business and you make revenues equal costs by cutting your costs. I think he's done more of that than he should have. I think he needs to look at the other side of the ledger and increase revenues.
Thanks for the call. Brad, we'll go to Carl now in West Allis. Carl, hi.
Hello. Yes, my brother retired from the Postal Service, a full-time worker, about roughly 15 years ago. And at that time, wages and other expenses were at issue. And my brother told me what he learned on the job and probably from the union is that there were three big issues at that time. He said that the top brass in the post office earned way too high of wages or their salaries, and that a lot of junk mail was a big loser money-wise. Now, you know, maybe...
Gotcha. Carl, we don't have too much time left. And this is maybe part of the DeJoy organization plan, figuring out how much revenue should come from things like we call junk mail?
Well, marketing mail revenue, which is what your caller's talking about, increased by about $1 billion last year, or about 42%. So the post office is actually making money on that. Where they're losing money now is on first-class mail. The revenue has increased, but it is still it's not meeting cost. So essentially, the delivery of newspapers or marketing mail is covering some of that cost. Package revenue has decreased about 8%. That's down about $54 million a quarter. And so the real question is, where's the future of the Postal Service? And I think reasonable first-class service is always going to be a money loser, but I think it's essential. The irony is that marketing mail is actually making money. So cut your costs. I think quit making payments on a debt you can never satisfy. Work on improvements to service, and that would include six-day-a-week service. And they've also got to replace their aging gasoline-powered delivery vehicles. There is a move now afoot and some preliminary funding to buy electric vehicles, and they do have a contract for that. So I think that's a step in the right direction. But I agree with your first caller. There's no reason the post office should be required to make money, but they've got to come close to breaking even, which is what we ask of the Weather Service, the Forest Service, the Park Service. The Postal Service fits in the same category.
And James, lightning round here, not too much time left. We got a caller saying Louis DeJoy should be removed from his job. What do you think? Should he stay or should he go?
Well, that's up to the Board of Governors, and they're determined by party. There are now five Democrats and four Republicans. It's their job to determine whether he keeps his job. And I couldn't predict how they would move on this, but I would say that while they're cautious, they're probably running out of patience at this point. He's got to bring the Postal Service to break even fairly soon, and I would argue with the help of the Congress.
We'll leave it there. James, thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
We've been talking to James O'Rourke, a teaching professor of management and organization at the University of Notre Dame's Mendoza College of Business. He's studied the U.S. Postal Service for over a decade. We've been talking about challenges facing the Postal Service and this new bill in Congress, just passed the U.S. House with a fair amount of bipartisan support. Updating, changing the financing of the Postal Service heads to the Senate now, where it looks likely to pass. still time for you to share your thoughts on the U.S. Postal Service, its present, its future. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Does the U.S. Supreme Court need some kind of reforms, big and or small? There are lots of ideas out there, including things like term limits, adding more justices, or a constitutional amendment some people are trying to get to lock in the number at exactly the current number, 9. Check out some of the options and join in with your thoughts on the U.S. Supreme Court. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Here's one way to keep people listening to your radio station. Make it so their cars can't turn it off. This story comes to us from our public radio colleagues at KUOW in Seattle. They've heard from multiple listeners who report a glitch in their car stereo systems. It shuts down their ability to control the audio, and it locks in KUOW all day, every day. That's weird. Also weird, it's only Mazda vehicles and only 2016 models. There might be some glitch in an update causing the problem. That's not solved yet. Mazda dealers in Seattle are apparently getting a lot of calls about the problem. I'm guessing KUOW didn't make this happen. That's not a very public radio way to get listeners. So I'll just say, keep listening and spread the word about the Ideas Network before your car radio gets ideas of its own. This is Central Time.